Greetings and lipidaceous libations, my frenetically multi-lobated listeners. Welcome to this October 2015 Science News Update. I'm your host for this lackadaisically saturnine science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Wow, no email from you guys out there in podcast land this month. Have you become bored with moi? Have I just increased your ennui beyond all possible bounds? Do you want to see my minky? Sorry, I lose control sometimes. First story of the night. Why do young children run so funny compared to adults? Now, I always thought it was because they were first learning to run. Until my son and daughter reached 5 or so, I watched them like a hawk when they were running around outside especially. I was quite worried they would upset themselves while running and end up on their faces. They never look stable. I mean, this actually seldom happened, but until they reached about 6, they looked clumsy as a 4-eyed horny toad on a hot plate. Whatever that is. Anyway, to put it simply, a toddler's stiff-legged waddle is completely different from an adult's fluid run. Dr. Jim Usherwood from the Royal Veterinary College in England decided he wanted to know exactly how a toddler's movements were different from those of an adult. And he published his results of those studies this month in the Journal of Experimental Biology. Usherwood recruited 18 kids, including 2 of his own daughters, ranging in age from about 1 to about 5 years in age, to find out more about their movements. Keeping the kids amused with balloons and bubbles, he used a camera system to track the position of reflective dots placed at specific locations on the children's limbs as they moved at various speeds along a track. At the same time, he measured the forces that they exerted on the floor. Usherwood was careful not to tell the kids what kind of gait to use. He did, however, ask them to either match their parents' speed or to go faster or slower, to not bias their movements. Usherwood found that since kids' legs are shorter than adults, this allows them less time to push up and away from the ground, providing their muscles with less time to contract and generate the power that they need to move, and leaving their feet on the ground for a longer proportion of each stride than adults do. He says, quote, "You can see by watching a 3-year-old running that they barely get off the ground," unquote. They built a model that represented moving people as a single piston that was the length of the individual's leg. And Usherwood calculated the amount of muscle required to produce the power necessary to propel the individuals along at speeds that he had measured. This new model successfully reproduced the youngsters' and adults' movements. So, what was the conclusion? Kids move the way they do simply because they are smaller than adults. Their short limbs do not have enough time to produce the high power needed to lift them into the air while running. Not because they are training to be good as adults, but simply because of physics. Okay. Here's a story from Wired magazine, which I guess just barely qualifies as science, but it's kind of interesting, so what the heck. Apparently, we have now officially run out of standard internet addresses. If you haven't really realized it, every computer, phone, and wired gadget that you own connects to the internet and has an internet protocol address, an IP address, a kind of numerical name tag for every device online. And the internet is rapidly running out of the most commonly used type of IP address, known as IPv4. Today, the American Registry for Internet Numbers, that's the organization responsible for issuing IP addresses in North America, said that it has run out of freely available IPv4 addresses. Now, that isn't going to affect normal internet users, but it's going to put more pressure on internet service providers, software companies, and big organizations to accelerate their migration from IPv4 to, ta-da, the successor, IPv6. I guess Wire reported back in 2011 that the internet had run out of IP addresses, or more specifically, that an organization called Internet Assigned Numbers Authority, IANA, had run out of IPv4 addresses. Basically, IANA hands out blocks of IP addresses to regional organizations like the American Registry for Internet Numbers and all its counterparts around the world. So even after IANA ran out, lots of IPv4 addresses were still available since 2011. But apparently now the regional organizations have run out as well, so there are no more. The president for the American Registry for Internet Numbers, John Curran, says that the organization isn't entirely out of IPv4 addresses. He says that some are set aside for specific purposes, like exchange sites where connections between different internet providers' networks meet. But providers that want new IP addresses will have to settle for the version 6 numbers unless old, unused version 4 addresses are returned to the organization. The organization has a waiting list for companies that want to get their hands on some of these recycled numbers. Technologists have known for years that we would run out of version 4 addresses, which is why the version 6 standard was created in the late 1990s. While the version 4 was limited to just about 4 billion addresses, version 6 will provide, get this, 340 undecillion addresses. That's a 1 followed by 36 zeros. Now, you can calculate this. It's enough to give 5 times 10 to the 28 addresses to every single person on Earth. And it's already supported by all major operating systems. The only problem is that version 4 and version 6 aren't entirely compatible. If you're on a version 6 network, you can't browse a site running on a web server using only version 4 without some sort of compatibility layer between them. Unfortunately, the internet service providers have been working hard to update their infrastructure and support both standards. The next story has to do with advances in brain scanning and what you can do, or soon will be able to do, with those scans. This story comes out of this month's issue of Nature Neuroscience, and the research was done by Dr. Todd Constable of Yale University. And the article was entitled, Functional Connectome Fingerprinting, Identifying Individuals Using Patterns of Brain Connectivity. And that title alone is enough to make you go, huh? Let me explain. Constable and his team have developed a method to pick out an individual solely by his or her connectome. What's a connectome? Well, it is the pattern of synchronized neural activity across a whole series of brain regions. Researchers have observed previously that brain connectivity is a unique trait, but this new study demonstrates that neural patterns retain an individual's signature even during different mental activities. In short, the connectome is a neural fingerprint. Constable says, quote, we were able to show it's not just the functional connectivity, which is how different brain regions are communicating over time when you're not doing a specific task, but even how the brain is activated during a specific task that is also very fingerprint-like. Constable extracted data from the Human Connectome Project, which includes functional MRI data from about 1,200 people so far. The Yale team analyzed imaging data from 268 different brain regions and 126 participants. And they created a connectome profile for each individual, and they measured how strongly the activity of a specific brain region compared to the activity of every other brain region. And this created an activity correlation matrix. Each person, it turns out, has a unique activity correlation matrix. And the team then used this profile to predict the identity of an individual in MRI scans for another session. Depending on the type of MRI scan that they took a look at, the researchers could nail somebody's identity with up to 99% accuracy. Scans during mental tasks rather than resting made it more difficult, and then the accuracy dropped to somewhere around 70%. Still, not too bad. Constable says, quote, even though brain function is always changing, and we saw it slightly harder to identify people when they are doing different things, people almost always look most similar to themselves. Unquote. The ability to identify individuals even during tasks on different days would be important for clinical applications. Think about it. Mental disorders are often classified by phenotype or symptoms, that may now represent a variety of underlying causes. And this technology could personalize mental health much better. I mean, we would have more information to say specifically what would be happening in your particular brain. Now, that's only part of the study. The second part of the study will be more interesting for a lot of people. Constable's group was also able to associate a person's connectome with his or her fluid intelligence. This trait is measured by asking people to solve a problem or find a pattern without using language or math skills or learned information. Constable says that stronger connections between the prefrontal and parietal lobes, brain regions already known to be involved in higher order thought, were most indicative of higher fluid intelligence scores. The results, he says, quote, suggest levels of integration of different brain systems are giving rise to superior cognitive ability, unquote. Yeah, what does that gobbledygook mean? Simply, they successfully used maps of people's brains to accurately predict intelligence. By intelligence, Constable means abstract reasoning ability, which they inferred by this mapping and analyzing of the connections within people's brains. But the study is compelling because it gets at a fundamental and probably kind of uncomfortable truth. Some brains are better than others at certain things, particularly because of the way they're wired. And now, scientists are closer to being able to determine precisely which brains those are and how they got that way. Imagine, in the future, scans could be used to predict if you are prone to addiction, prone to violence, predisposed to having delusions. It's nasty. It's a double-edged sword. You may be able to help a kid learn better in school by determining how their specific brain works, but imagine the schools could then use data to guide admissions decisions. Companies could use that data to hire based on mental aptitude. Insurance companies could base coverage on cognitive dispositions or predispositions. Predictive brain scanning could lead to a whole new form of what we could call neurodiscrimination. Picture this, fellow citizens of Terra. The world could be soon just as stupid as the Divergent movies. Makes you think, don't it? Okay. This may never have occurred to you before, but large animals, like elephants, really don't get cancer very much. Don't believe me? Ask any zookeeper. Go ahead. I'll wait. See? Cancer just doesn't account for large animal death very often. This is kind of a surprising finding. With about 100 times as many cells as a human, a 4,800-kilogram African elephant should, in theory, be more prone to accruing mutations that cause one of those cells to grow out of control. But elephants and other large mammals have surprisingly low rates of cancer, despite living for decades. Dr. Joshua Schiffman, a pediatric oncologist at the University of Utah, has wondered about this weird paradox for years. And he has finally examined it, along with his group, in a study published in the journal Nature last month. Schiffman and his colleagues scoured the genome of an African elephant and found 40 copies of the P53 gene. Now, P53 is a major anti-cancer gene. The Asian elephant genome contains between 30 and 40 copies of P53. To put that value of 30 to 40 in perspective, humans have two copies. It's a little like 30 or 40 guards guarding a castle as opposed to two guarding a castle. Which is more likely to be invaded? Think about it. Weirdly enough, Schiffman found that elephant cells were no better at repairing DNA damage than human cells. In vitro experiments revealed that if they got damaged, there really wasn't a better likelihood that one would be repaired as opposed to the other. Instead, he has results that suggest that P53 helped the elephants kill off precancerous cells before they become cancerous, not after they become cancerous. Another study, published October 6th, on the server BioRxiv, or is that BioPrescription 4? I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce that. Anyway, it also found dozens of copies of the P53 gene in the elephant genome, as well as dozens in two extinct species of mammoth. Dr. Vincent Lynch of the University of Chicago speculates that P53 P-53 duplicated as elephant ancestors began to grow in size, but noted that this is likely not the only mechanism to explain the lineage's cancer resistance. Well, one colleague I know who specializes in cancer poo-pooed these protective notions, and he said this, quote, "Yes, those results are kind of cool, and they may even be true. But think about it. Elephants don't exactly live the same lifestyle as humans do. What would happen if elephants smoked and had a bad diet? Would they really be protected from cancer? I doubt it." Okay, so he sounds a bit negative. But you have to give him credit for having a healthy dose of scientific skepticism, which, after all, is kind of really good for scientists to thrive on. All right, next story. More news in the area of epigenetics. In the last 10 years or so, it's become quite clear that parents' life experiences can alter germ cells, and events in parents' lives can influence the health and behavior of their children, and even their grandchildren. But it can be difficult to establish a causal connection between epigenetic changes and changes in behavior and health. Dr. Tracy Bale of the University of Pennsylvania has now demonstrated that an increase in a group of microRNAs in sperm cells from stressed male mice can lead to altered stress response in their adult offspring. And that work was published in the last couple of weeks in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Her study improves on previous ones by identifying specific microRNAs that transmit stress to offspring. Further, the new paper shows that injected microRNAs reduce or completely knock out expression of specific genes in the zygotes, the embryos, which is really kind of the coolest finding in the paper. Now, many of you are sitting there going, he's talking about microRNAs? What is that, a little tiny RNA? Okay, sure. What? Let me explain. MicroRNAs have been discovered in the last 10 years or so. And they are. They're very small RNAs. But most of you may have learned in high school biology or college biology that a messenger RNA, for example, is used to help make proteins. It's used as a message that's the intermediary between the DNA and the ribosome. It's sent to the ribosome, and in the ribosome, it's used to encode for proteins in the translation process. Well, microRNA is generally never translated. It's not used to make proteins. It's a regulatory sequence. So these are short regulatory sequences that actually bind to messenger RNA, and they're used to regulate the messenger RNA and whether it's translated or not. If a microRNA were to bind, and they can be directed very specifically at RNAs, so if a microRNA binds to a messenger RNA, then a whole series of enzymatic compounds are directed at that messenger, at that transcript, to destroy it. So microRNAs are used to regulate whether mRNA is going to be used at all. And it's a very, very strong regulatory system. So Bale and her colleagues injected 9 of these microRNAs into zygotes from healthy mice and implanted the zygotes in females and then allowed them to mature. The resulting mice showed the same altered corticosteroid release levels in response to being restrained as mice descended from stressed fathers, even though their fathers were not exposed to stress. This suggests that some combination of the 9 altered microRNAs is responsible for transmitting that paternal stress to the offspring. MicroRNAs knock down expression of target genes. Using other injected zygotes, the researchers measured expression of those messenger RNAs of 9 known targets in the injected zygotes a day after injection. As expected, many of the targets of the microRNAs were knocked down. The researchers also surveyed hypothalamic gene expression in mice derived from zygote microinjections. Why? Well, Bale says this, quote, "The hypothalamus is what determines everything about how you survive. Your eating, your sleeping, your circadian rhythms, your stress, your reproduction," unquote. She and her colleagues found that expression of a variety of genes encoding proteins related to collagen and extracellular matrix were reduced. It remains unclear how knocking down expression of certain genes in zygotes via microRNA leads to altered stress responses in adult animals and altered gene expression in the brain. I mean, the best known understanding of epigenetic controls or regulations are through DNA methylations or chromatin modifications, actually altering the three-dimensional structure of the DNA. MicroRNA levels in mammals don't persist from cell division to cell division, so how exactly are they controlling what's going on a generation later? Bale's group will next try to identify epigenetic changes in embryos that might allow microRNA changes to have an effect in adult animals. It's possible that some of the genes that were knocked down themselves may influence epigenetic modifications. That could explain what they're seeing. Now, the last story of the night should probably be barred from sensitive ears, so you may want to just drop out now if either you are sensitive or there are kitties listening in. Not only is there a serious ick factor to this next story, but it does involve, well, reproduction. And no, I don't mean Vulcan reproduction. I will give you a full 10 seconds to opt out starting now. Okay. For those of you who are still with me, remember I warned you. So there are lots of organisms on this earth, and we take for granted sometimes that many do not produce in a way that is even close to the way mammals do. Dr. Stephen Ram and his colleagues in a recent issue of the Proceedings of the Royal Society demonstrated these differences to be an absolute in this very, very strange world that we live in. In short, one organism's trauma may be another's only shot at family life. We all have different ideas of the meaning of trauma. For example, I'm pretty much untroubled by spiders, while I have friends who shriek at the mere mention of a spider. But how about this one? What about a syringe full of sperm shot into your head? I know, ew, but I would say that is pretty traumatic for most people. Macrostomum hystrix is a tiny flatworm with an utterly bizarre sex life. In contrast to mammals with two separate sexes, these worms are simultaneous hermaphrodites, meaning that they are both male and female at the same time. This is not something that is very easily obtained in mammals. It's very hard to develop that way. As a consequence, while it takes two humans to tangle, these worms can go at it alone and self-fertilize. Now, mind you, there are lots of species that fall into this category, so it's not that unusual. And yet the freakiness of macrostomum is the manner in which self-fertilization occurs. What Ram found is that macro worms accomplish this trick by injecting sperm from their needle-like penises into their own heads. And again, I hear the ewes out there. And the more sperm they inject, the more offspring they produce. Why the head? Well, anatomical constraints. It's the easiest spot to reach. Unsurprisingly, hypodermic self-fertilization, also known as, quote, traumatic insemination, unquote, is not the best reproductive choice for these worms. In previous studies, the team found that offspring produced by sulfing survived less well and were less fecund than offspring produced by outcrossing. So given these costs, why bother? Well, because they have to. I mean, this is not just a weird kind of sex addiction here. It's an absolute necessity to ensure the next generation of freaky little worms will survive. Selfing involves a crucial problem for macro by assuring reproduction when opportunities to outcross are limited. Most plants can get by on this approach, as do a sizable fraction of animals, so why not? For a start, selfing animals entirely dispense with the risks and hassles of finding a mate. Additionally, their offspring are, well, 100% their own. However, selfing incurs serious costs, in particular the risk of inbreeding depression in their offspring. Inbreeding depression is the loss of viable offspring in the long term. Because of this cost, worms are quite reluctant to self-fertilize, waiting more than 50% longer than when they are given the chance to outcross. But a worm's life is short. When rams separated them from their potential mating partners, they went straight for their own heads. Cue the ewes. Although peculiar and even a little amusing, the behavior of these worms does make perfect sense from a reproductive standpoint. Some reproduction is clearly better than the trauma of none. But what remains unclear is the cost to the worms themselves. You can imagine that traumatic self-insemination may do a worm about as much good as, well, a hole in the head. I guess one of the questions that arises from this is, do they live shorter lives than the outcrossed worms? I mean, do these holes in the heads actually become a problem? And can they continue feeding as efficiently? The answer to these questions remain unsolved. So there is still much to learn about these interesting little creatures. That's all for me for now. As always, take care. Keep watching those toddlers as they run. Put off those intelligence brain scans as long as you possibly can. Don't even consider traumatic self-insemination. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Till next time, this is Jim Campanella.